The following recording is copyrighted material and cannot be duplicated or distributed in either physical or electronic formats. For additional copies of this material, please visit www.ancientpathsweb.com. Thank you for listening. Now sit back and enjoy Sue Pruitt, the Charlotte Mason Girl, give you an introduction into using a Charlotte Mason education with your children.
Well, before we begin, let's just have a quick word of prayer, please. Dear Lord, I thank you so much for today, and I thank you for the opportunity to share some of the lessons that you've taught me, and I pray that you'll make my words clear and that I will be able to be an encouragement to the people who are here. And Lord, I pray that you just guide us all in wisdom as we learn how you want us to teach our children. And I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, well, just first of all, by way of introduction, my name is Sue Pruitt, and I call myself the Charlotte Mason Girl because I just am one. We started homeschooling. We're in our ninth year now, so we started way back in 2000. And as we got started in it, I learned about Charlotte Mason. It was very interesting to me. I started reading articles and learning tidbits really here and there. And as I learned about it, I would apply what I learned. And along the way, I've been able to learn more and more. And as we've gone through all the changes in our family, we have 5 children. Our oldest is 14 and our youngest is 3. And so we had a time in there where I went through 3 years that I was solidly nursing or pregnant, and I was a little stressed out, and my husband said, let's get something that might be a little easier for you. And so he got me one of those curriculum in a box thing deals, and when I started working with it, it just drove me and the kids all nuts, and I realized I'm just a Charlotte Mason girl, and I just had to go back to it, and so I'm back to stay no matter what. And so that's where I'm at, and that's how we ended up where we are today. I'll share with you what got me started, what really turned on the light bulb for me when it came to a Charlotte Mason education, is this book by Karen Andreola called A Charlotte Mason Companion, and the subtitle is what grabbed my attention, Personal Reflections on the Gentle Art of Learning. That's what I wanted learning to be for my children. I wanted it to be gentle and natural, and that caught my attention, so I picked up this book and I started reading it. And Karen takes the method and all the different aspects of what a Charlotte Mason education is, and she tells you what they are. She explains it in a very easy-to-read style, but then she brings you into her home, and she says, this is what we did, and this is what my children did, and this is the fruit of it. And she's got very well-educated children. It was really inspiring to me, and so many times I went, I get it now why we do that. And so then I really just took off teaching with Charlotte Mason's methods, and so that's the book that really turned me on to it. As I said, it's a very gentle, very natural way to educate your children. So much of it, as we go through today, I'll show you, so much of it is stuff that your children already do very naturally, and so this just blends right, it just works right in with it. Another reason I really like this method is because it makes me very dependent on the Holy Spirit to lead me. It's not in a box. It doesn't come. Nobody comes and says, okay, in second grade you got to read these books and they got to learn this and do that and all that. You have to really follow the Holy Spirit's leading and know your children. And so that's another reason that I really like it, is that it has actually helped me to be more dependent on the Holy Spirit. It is less expensive. It's a little cheaper than doing the... I mean, you can go all out and buy all the books and everything, but if you've got a library card, you can do this method very easily. I'll just give one caution here early on. I love this method of teaching. I'm very enthusiastic about it, and our family, I don't think we could do it any other way. And so I can really come across as, this is the way for everybody to educate their children. I know there's other great methods out there, and I hope that you all just pray for wisdom about how God wants you to teach your children. So don't walk away from here thinking that I think this is the only right way to educate your children, but it is right for us, and it's a great way to do it, and so I'm very enthusiastic about it. So just get that caution in your mind as we move through. Well, who was Charlotte Mason, first of all? She was an educator around the turn of the century, last century, not the most recent one, in England, and one of the things that got her really going and really working so hard for great education for children, she had to really fight the idea in society that if a child was born poor, then they were a bad child and they didn't deserve an education. That was really the prevailing thought in society at that time. And she said, no, all children are capable of learning much and they should be given a great education. And so she really fought for that, and she knew children so well. She spent her entire life learning how children think and how they learn and putting that into action. She actually trained many educators. She had a school that she taught teachers how to teach with her way, and that spread all throughout England. And then with the resurgence of the homeschooling movement here in America, her ideals have really become popular again. It's been brought over here, and people are being made aware of it. So let's talk about what constitutes a Charlotte Mason education. I'm going to kind of fly through all the different subjects, and I'll go back and visit each one. The core of a Charlotte Mason education is using living books, real books, and I'll go into that in greater detail later, but that's really the core of it. You use narration. Your children are going to retell you what you've read to them or what they have read on their own. They're going to tell it back to you. That's narration. You do a picture study, an artist study, and some of the great artists from the past, some modern day, all different time periods. You'll do a composer study. You're going to learn about the great classical composers, great classical music. Not the Beatles, but classical music. You'll do nature study, which is the beginning of science, is learning about God's creation by being out in it. You will study poetry and poets. And even the youngest students enjoy hearing a great poem. You'll do copy work. Your children will copy from great writers. What better way to get inspired with great ideas than to copy what great writers have already written. Okay, let's take a closer look at each part. Living books. What is a living book? A living book is written by one author who is passionate about the subject that they've written about. This is somebody, when you pick up a book about any subject, that somebody loved that subject enough and they were passionate enough about it that they spent a part of their life studying that subject and they wrote a book about it and they got it published. That's a living book. One author who's passionate. You'll find living books that way. Charlotte Mason said they are fresh and finely expressed. It inspires the imagination of your children. It captures their attention. Charlotte said that they need to bring truth, nobility, and beauty into a child's life. That's a good living book. Some of the living books that we have used are the Bible, which is the ultimate living book. We've read biographies of great people in history. When we're studying a time period in history, we will read biographies of the individuals who lived at that time. Right now, we're kind of in the exploration phase in our history studies, and we've been reading lots about Marco Polo. We're getting ready to, my son's getting ready to read J.A. Henty's book about Cortez in Mexico. So those are the types of things that you do. You just bring in whatever your time period you're studying, find people who lived at that time period, read biographies about them. Somebody was enthusiastic enough about that person to write a book about it. And some of them are better than others, and you'll find out. How do you know if you have a living book? Give it the one-page test is what Karen Andreoli recommends. You take the book, you open it up, and you sit down with your children, and you read one page, maybe two pages, and you close the book, and you say, we're done for today. If they clamor and ask you to read more, you found a good living book, because it's something that has captured their imagination and they're hungry for more of it. My older children have read Narnia books, The Hobbit. Those have been kind of great escapes for them when they don't want to necessarily read all the true stuff. Those are good fiction books to read. The circumference books have been a great math one for especially my oldest daughter. She really doesn't enjoy math, and it's a good story introduction of math, and it's circumference. It's about a knight, and so it's sir as in S-I-R, and then conference. And there's four or five in the series, and they talk about all the different geometry, all the different aspects of geometry. So those are really good. The Little House on the Prairie books, those are great family read alouds. There's a book called Five Little Peppers and How They Grew. The Cole Family Christmas. There's all kinds of great ones out there. Some of the places you can go to find a good list of living books, there's Honey for a Child's Heart. That was written by Gladys Hunt. The Read Aloud Handbook. That's by Jim Trelease, I think is how you say his last name. Books Children Love. It's another book. And now I don't remember who authored that one. I didn't write that down. And Newbery Award winners. Those are all potential resources to find good living books. The thing about a living book is that it takes a great author, a great mind, the author's mind, and you allow the child to be put directly in touch with that author's thoughts through their book. When you're reading a child a book in a Charlotte Mason education, you're not going to tell them what to think about the book before they read it. You're not going to say, okay, this is a book about this, and this is what it's going to tell you, and all that kind of thing. You just say, here's this book, and you put them in touch with it, and you step back out of the way. Charlotte did not want a child's education to be about the teacher. She wanted it to be about the education, learning the great things that they could learn from the great books. Now, narration ties directly into this. Narration is something that children do very naturally. When they're young and something happens to them, they get to do something, what have you, they're going to want to tell you about it. Our children, when dad gets home in the evening, they want to clamor and go tell him everything that happened today. If we got to go to the park or what have you, even our three-year-old son, Benjamin, he will tell daddy exactly what happened today. He'll tell him what he jumped off of and how he fell, and he'll do physical demonstrations with it. That's narration. He's telling something that happened, something that he was exposed to that day, and it's something that children do very naturally. My four-year-old Samantha, she loves to tell dad about whatever book was read to her that day, or however many books we read to her that day. It usually takes two of us to keep up with her on books. But she'll go and she'll tell dad about the story, and that's very natural for them to do. Well, that's all you do, is you just keep asking them to do that. And the older they get, really, you don't start formal narration until around the age of 6 or 7. Before that, don't push it. Just let them do it naturally. Let it be spontaneous. But at about age 6 or 7, take a book, something that they've never heard before, and read them a couple of paragraphs, and then say, okay, now, Johnny, I want you to tell me what I just read to you in your own words. At first, they might, if they're a child who loves to tell stories, they'll just go right into it. If they're one that doesn't come for so naturally, you may have to prompt them a little bit, but don't prompt them a lot. It's reading comprehension without the test afterwards. You're just asking them to explain to you what they just heard or what they just read, and you'll know from what they tell you if they understood what they just read. They don't have to answer a certain list of questions for it. You just have them tell you, and you'll know whether or not they understand it. The older they get, they'll do longer passages. My oldest student is 14, and she does whole chapters of chapter books now, and she actually will write hers out for me. She doesn't necessarily have to tell them to me orally. Don't push the writing on them of the narrations too early. Let them do it orally for as long as they need to. My son is still doing mostly oral narrations, and he's 11. So just you can really be, like I said, it's gentle. Go with what's natural for them in that area. One of the things that is such a benefit of narration, again, I said it's reading comprehension, they are internalizing what they have read or what has been read to them. I don't know if you've ever noticed, but as you're learning things to teach your children, you learn it probably better than you've ever learned it before when you need to teach somebody else. I know that's how I am. When I need to learn something good enough to teach it, I know it better now than when I learned it the first time. So you're helping your children do that. If they have to tell you back the story, they're already in their own mind asking themselves questions like, what happened next and who did what and those kinds of things, and they're going to tell you as they go. it does help them with putting things in proper sequence. That's probably the main question I will ask my children as they're doing a narration. If they start a narration and they get stuck, or they finish and I think, boy, you skipped a lot there, I'll say, well, what happened next? Or what else happened when Sarah said this, or whatever in the story? And I will pull them out. Mostly it's what happened next is my main question, because I'm getting them to think about things in order. So it's really good about that. When you are listening to a narration from your child, don't correct them in the middle of the narration, especially when they're younger. It breaks the flow of thought for them, and sometimes they can't gain it back. So let them do the whole narration, and if there were major mistakes in it, go back and correct it gently. Again, this is really gentle. Go back and say, you know, you said that Tom did this, but wasn't that really John, or didn't Tom do something else? And have them think about, oh yeah, Tom, he really was, you know, across the street, whatever it was. I'm not thinking of a certain book right now, but whatever it was. And one of the great quotes I read is, and it's something that I try to keep in my mind, and I just wrote down the quote, I didn't write down who said it, but it was, the gift of language is not a trivial thing. As you put your children in touch with great authors and you help them to get the idea of the story, and as they're telling it back, they are developing their language. As they read books that are harder and harder, their vocabulary is growing. This is not something trivial. It's sometimes hard to make yourself sit down and listen to a child tell you their narration. I have to really kind of force myself to do it sometimes, because I tend to be kind of a, I want to keep moving through my day type gal. And so this forces me to sit down and stop and listen to my children, look them in the eye, and it allows them time with me. It allows them to really be able to concentrate if I will stop and listen, and it's good for our day. Okay, picture study. Generally what we do is we pick one artist per term to study. And again, I encourage you to pick artists from all different time periods. We've kind of coordinated it with our history study. Whatever period we were in history, we try to look at either art or an artist from that period. You want to pick anywhere from 6 to 8 of that artist's works. And what you're going to do is you're going to have one work each week. And it's best if you can have something that has some size. You want to see the work in detail. We don't live near the Metropolitan Art Museum, so there aren't things available. There's not a lot available for us. So when we studied Van Gogh, I actually found this book at a library sale for $3. Those are great places to go get books. If I ever decide we're done with this book and we don't need it anymore, I can always give it back to the library folks and they can sell it again. I won't mind, because I only paid $3 for it. But what we did was we just picked one picture per week. We just let the children look at it. This was a great one for all of us to sit around the table, because it's big enough for all of us to see. You let the children look at it for a few minutes. Just give them a chance to just look at the picture and study it without saying anything. Don't tell them what to think about it. Don't say, look at what that person's doing and what flower that is or whatever. Just let them look at the picture and for themselves and make a connection with that artist in their own mind. Then you have the children narrate that picture to you, just like you do a story. If they're younger, let them keep the picture in front of them and let them tell you. Just ask them, what do you see in this picture? And let them begin to tell you. Sometimes, quite naturally, they're going to put a story behind that picture. They're going to say, well, that's a guy who is fishing for his family because they're hungry and they need fish. You're going to ask them, what kind of colors do you see in it? What are they doing? You may have to prompt them a little bit when they're younger, but just let them tell you about the picture themselves. As they get older, they'll get to a place where you can let them look at the picture for, say, 10 or 15 minutes. I wouldn't go any longer than that, because then they're going to fall asleep. But let them really look at it and study it. Turn it over or turn it away from them and ask them to tell you about the picture and see what kind of details they notice. Another way that we have done it is there's through Ambleside Online, and I've got a resource sheet back there, and that's going to have it on there. You can actually find some works of art and print them out yourself. And so I've done that for them too sometimes. And then each one of them gets a sheet to put in their own notebook. And so then they can hold it for themselves right up close and study it. And I was amazed because I really am not an art. I don't have an artistic bone in my body. I don't know anything about art. I was really amazed that really after looking at, say, 6 or 8 pieces of one artist's work, you get to develop an eye for that artist's style and what type of subject matter they painted and that kind of thing. And now we studied Botticelli earlier. I hope I'm not butchering his name, but we studied him last fall, and I was amazed because then somewhere down the line, I don't know if it was on the internet or what, I saw a picture and I went, that looks like a Botticelli picture, and I was right. And so your kids will develop that same eye. They'll begin to see when they see a painting, if you studied that artist, they may recognize it and know. And that was a big deal to me because, like I said, I know nothing about art. I could walk into a museum and go, all these paintings are great, but I didn't have a clue about any of the artists. As we're studying an artist, if you can find a short biography about that artist to read to your children, that's another good idea. It lets them know about when they lived, where they lived, what they experienced in their life, where their art came from. And it's amazing, as you guys know, but your children don't. Many of these artists were not necessarily real popular while they were alive. They may have died dirt poor, and now their paintings are selling for millions of dollars a piece. You know, they actually were great artists. It just wasn't recognized in their lifetime. So it's fun for your children to learn not only about the paintings and such, but about the person behind the paintings. Sometimes, if the kids are interested in doing it, or sometimes I just ask them to do it, I ask them to draw the picture for themselves. And when we start out, it's usually just a pencil drawing. They just use a pencil and they just try to copy it to the best of their ability. So far, I haven't got a blooming artist that really copies. But you never know. So at some point you're going to find that one of your children may really be drawn to this and may be able to copy some great works, and that may inspire their own art later. So it's a wonderful thing for them to be able to do it. Okay, then we do composer and music study, and we just put those together. We do the same thing as we do for the artist. We pick one composer per term, and we listen to their music. What I've got is I've got some CDs that have like 20 or 25 little pieces from that composer, and we'll listen to that every two or three times a week throughout that term. You can also, through the library, check out CDs that will have whole pieces on them, and we've done that before too. You want to let your children listen to the music frequently enough that they begin to recognize it. They can anticipate what's coming up in the next few seconds or what have you, and they learn the music. There's a great book that we've used along with this called Spiritual Lives of the Great Composers, and I just got that at the library, and I just check it out every so often. And whoever we're studying, it has like 2 to 4 page biography of each composer in there, and it tells about their life, where their music came from, how they studied. It's amazing how many of those composers were born into dirt poor families, and they had a love for music, but their family really didn't have a way to provide it for them, but God worked it out so that they were able to learn and become great composers, and some of them were listening to their music centuries later. So it's really fun for your children to see that. It's been amazing because I discovered, I don't know anything about music either, I discovered that there's a lot of that music in our society, in commercials. I couldn't believe, there was one piece I heard, I'm like, that's the Lexus commercial. So it's just amazing, and your children will learn to get an ear for each composer. Tchaikovsky is very different from Beethoven, and they're going to recognize those differences once they have studied them for a while. We listen to our music a lot of times when they are drawing, sometimes over a meal, when we're running errands. You can do it lots of different ways, whatever suits your family. The next thing is nature study. This is really fun. And especially when they're young, this is probably going to be one of the primary parts of your Charlotte Mason education. Nature study is what it sounds like. It's going out into nature and looking at what's there and letting your children get in touch with the Creator through His creation. it's amazing what you can do. You can do it anywhere, your backyard, the local park, out in the country, out in the woods. There's all kinds of places to do it. Last year, our 7-year-old daughter Esther had, we've got those little bug catcher cages, you know, she caught a caterpillar. And lo and behold, before the day was over, that caterpillar started making a cocoon. Woo! We got all excited. And so she was able to look at that every day, many times a day. She watched that cocoon, and I don't think she actually saw him coming out of the cocoon, but one day she comes and looks in her bug box, and what does she find but a moth? I didn't know what it was going to be. I just, wow, that was really exciting to me. And she kept that moth for that in there for a little while for that day, and then you let it go. Make sure they let it go soon because they're hungry. But you know, she could have learned about the life cycle of a moth by doing a little lap book on it and talk about all the different stages that they go through and drawing pictures and drawing the circle and all that kind of thing. And that would have been fine. But don't you think she knows the life cycle of a moth now because she watched it happen? And those are the types of things that can happen when you let your children. And let me tell you, she caught that caterpillar at about 10 o'clock in the morning during the school day. God just keeps showing me how great it is for my kids to be at home and learning at home. And she was able to look at that all throughout the day, every day, for about 2 weeks, I think it was, that she had that in there. So nature study, just get out there and see what's out there. You can use all kinds of things. We've got little guides. This one just happens to be on butterflies. When you spot a butterfly, you can, if you've got this with you, you can go, oh, let's look that up on the guide and see what kind it is. And we've got the Comstock. This is something you'll hear a lot in Charlotte Mason circles, the Comstock Handbook of Nature Study. This is a really big resource. It's not a book to sit down and just read, but it's a great resource. When you're out in your yard, in the woods, whatever, and you see a plant, a bug, a rock, whatever, and you don't really know what it is, it's probably in here. You can go back home and look it up and learn together with your children. So that's a great thing to use. Okay, poetry. Again, we pick a poet, one or two per term. We read some of their poetry. I usually try to have the children memorize at least one of their poems a week. That's great to put their minds. Again, when you're having them memorize a poem, what great noble thoughts can go into their heads through the poetry that they memorize? It is very inspiring to watch your 8-year-old son narrate a poem that I'm trying to remember the name of the poem now, what he did. It was about the Birkenhead. The Birkenhead drill, the ship that sunk, and the men who went down with it that saved their families. Listen to him narrate that poem. I was just getting goosebumps, and it just inspires them again to nobility. That was one for nobility. You're putting your children's mind in direct touch with a great poet. One of the things that happened this year that I got really excited about when I found a book of poems at the library, and it had a CD with it where some of the actual authors of those poems were reading the poem, and so the child could follow along and listen to it at the same time. Well, my oldest daughter, Rebecca, came to me. She was so excited because there was a poem in there from The Hobbit. It was Bilbo's poem that Frodo performed at Bilbo's birthday party. If you've ever read Narnia and The Hobbit, you know what I'm talking about. These are just characters that are in there. And she's read The Hobbit, and Rebecca came to me, and she said, I'm so excited that poem is in there. I like that poem so much, I copied it down and put it in my notebook. And I just said, yes, that's the goal. You want your children to love that stuff so much, pretty soon they're going to find it for themselves, and they're going to start copying down the things that inspire them, and they're going to save them. And that, what a great education. And that leads me right into copy work. This is how I teach my children to write. First, I put them through a course where they learn how to actually write the letters, and you know, we use italic, and so they go through and they learn that. And as soon as they can write some on their own, I start giving them copy work to do, and it starts out real small. Like we start in the Proverbs usually, because those are really nice short little snippets, and you just have them copy down something. At least you copy one thing every day, and it builds up their own skill in the handwriting, but it also exposes their mind again to great writers. They, once you've done some out of scripture, you can do excerpts out of books. There's probably more than one. There's a company that I like, the Queen's Homeschool. They actually put together books of copy work. So if you don't want to come up with it every day, you can actually get a book that has like 120 lessons in it or whatever, and they're very reasonable, and you can just say to your child each day, do one of these, and there are great quotes in here, excerpts from great books. And as your child is copying, they're learning spelling, they're learning punctuation, they're learning what sounds right for grammar and word usage and things like that. My oldest daughter, Rebecca, we assigned her to write a review for a book one day that we were going to put on our website, and she went and wrote it, and she came back and handed it to me and said, here it is, and I read it, and I said to her, did you copy this off the back of that book? Because that's exactly what it sounded like to me. It was just, you know, a really passionate endorsement of the book, and it was very well written, and she was very crushed because she said, no, I wrote it myself. When I start seeing the things that they've written themselves, that's when I've realized I'm seeing the fruit now. I'm starting to see it. I'm very thrilled about that because you don't always see it every day, but we've been able to see it now. And it's just wonderful to see your children bloom and begin to grow in fruit. That's basically the curriculum of a Charlotte Mason education. Pray and ask the Lord, who do you want us to study in each of these different subjects? History for us is our core. That's what we kind of base our whole homeschool on. Whatever time period we're studying in history, we kind of do everything else off of that. So that's kind of the direction that we have gone with that. One of the things to remember, all of these things that you do, with the exception of nature study, very short lessons, especially the younger they are, the shorter they should be. 5, 10, 15 minutes at the most. Because it encourages your child to give attention to what you're saying, to give attention to the lesson, because they know it's not going to drag on forever. And then you're done. You're done with it for today. I started doing that because it was what Charlotte Mason said to do, and I said, okay, I'll do it. It just didn't seem like it was going to get anywhere for us, but we started doing it. When my oldest daughter was in, I think she was in third grade, we started using this book, Simply Grammar by Karen Andriola, and it's got grammar lessons in it. And each lesson is very short, and the first lesson is just about the two parts of a sentence. There is a person or thing of which we speak, and what we say about it. That's the two parts of a sentence. That was our first lesson. We read a couple of pages, and she wrote a couple of words out to answer some questions, and that was it. And we did that every day for a while, and I thought, she's not learning anything. These lessons, there's no meat to them. There's nothing to it. 2 months later, she still remembered things that we had talked about 2 months ago, and she had it down. And then when I've seen her writing that she's done on her own, she's got good grammar, really good grammar. Spelling we have to work on, but good grammar. So it works to do nice short lessons. Okay, why is this one great option for families, especially, and I shared with you, we have 5 children. So that means that I've got a pretty good age range. Our oldest is 14, our youngest is 3. So it's been great for us because it breaks down all those age barriers. I don't have to have this set of stuff for my 8th grader, this set of stuff for my 5th grader, this set of stuff for my 2nd grader, and I don't know what I'm going to do with the preschoolers. I can tell all the kids to gather around, and we read whatever book we're reading all together. They're all there in the room. Now, my 3-year-old doesn't understand everything that I'm reading, but he's hearing those words. And his vocabulary is growing because he's hearing that. My 4-year-old is gaining comprehension of things that I would never have read to a 4-year-old. You know, when my oldest was 4, I didn't read her those things. But my 4-year-old now is gaining and growing. So as you read ahead of their reading level, you're stretching them. It also makes the older children learn to be patient and gentle with their younger siblings, because there's times that the lesson gets interrupted for some interruption for the little ones, and we have to be patient with them. My oldest daughter loves now to bring her 4-year-old sister along when she's in the kitchen doing something, and she very patiently works with her. I was not a patient mother early on, and I didn't bring my oldest daughter into the kitchen when she was 4. I said, go play and let me work. But Rebecca's been able to do that with Samantha, and it's really been fun to watch. It's been great to watch. This is a gentle method. As long as you're gentle, the method is gentle. I encourage you, don't stress out about wanting to hurry up and see fruit today, this week, or this year. You know, when I first started homeschooling, I heard all the great statistics about how homeschool students are years ahead of their peers in all the different subjects, and they do great on all the standardized tests. And so I thought to myself, we've got to be 2 years ahead on everything. And I started cramming things into my oldest daughter. We've got to hurry up. We've got to get to second grade fast, you know. And I totally stressed her out. I was totally stressed out. It was not a good scene for a while. But I finally did learn to relax and to be gentle and to let things flow. Let God work in their hearts. Let them learn at their own pace. Let them make the connection with the author. I don't have to tell them what to think about it all the time. They can make that connection with that author. So our results have been incredible. I've been surprised at what has happened. You know, sometimes I am uncertain when I'm teaching my children. I think, oh, I don't know if I'm covering something good enough, or I don't know what to do next, or what have you. But what that does is it forces me to depend on the Lord and the Holy Spirit to guide me. And so for that, I think it's good. I think it's good for my kids to see me dependent on Him and following His leading in our life. We have done some standardized testing with our children. The oldest two, we've done it 3 times with our oldest and once now with our second child. And in virtually every subject, they've tested years ahead of their peers. I never would have thought that happened. Didn't feel like we were really getting that far ahead in things. But they actually did test quite a bit ahead of their peers in basically every subject. Another thing about this method is it really feeds into that homeschooling lifestyle. We do school all the time. We're always learning. I don't call it school all the time. We're always learning together as a family. We were driving home from Iowa in January, and it was the time when the eagles were really active around the bridge up in Keokuk, Iowa. And so we took some time, and we pulled over, and we stopped, and we had some binoculars with us, and we watched the eagles. There were a couple of them sitting on trees not too far away. And with those binoculars, boy, it looked like they were right here. So everybody passed the binoculars around. Even the 3-year-old, you know, he's doing this. I'm sure he didn't see really an eagle. But everybody was looking at him. And we got to see a couple of them dive down and get a fish out of the river. That was just cool. You could see that on a movie. You could. I mean, there's movies with that in there. But, man, it's just exciting to watch it happen for real. The kids got really enthusiastic about it. A couple weeks after that, I don't remember, we were driving somewhere, and we listen to talk radio a lot, too, and somebody said something about the Cold War, and my son, I think it was my son, he said, Mom, what was the Cold War? And that started about a 15-minute discussion on the Cold War. My husband was with us, and, you know, we kind of came up, and we first began to become aware of what was going on, you know, nationally and in the world, when Reagan was in office and when the Cold War was coming to an end. And so we lived through it. So we were able to tell them what we knew about it. We talked for about 15 or 20 minutes. It was just what we already knew. And our kids came away with kind of having an idea of what the Cold War was all about. I didn't have to go get that textbook and make sure I told them every fact and da-da-da-da-da. I just told them what I knew. I heard Cindy Rushton say one time, she said, teach your children what you have in your hand. What you know, teach them. And that was such a comfort to me. I thought, oh, I don't have to go out and find what somebody else knows all the time. I can teach them what I know. I try to do a read aloud at home with the kids during the day, as well as we try to do one in the evenings a lot of times. And when we do that read aloud during the day, oftentimes when Dad comes home for supper and he's sitting at the table, he hears from one or more of the kids about what the story was and what happened in it today and all that kind of thing. They're just doing that narration. So a lot of times I just wait till supper, and that's our narration time. So, okay, I wanted to let you know, I've got resources up here that I use. Some of them I've used extensively. Some of them I'm getting ready to use. Some of them I've used just a little bit, but you can come up and look at that when you're done. We have a resource sheet on the back table there that you can grab. It's got websites on it. I'll point you to, I have a blog. It's called the Charlotte Mason Girl. typepad.com, and so you can go there, and I talk a lot about what I've learned about Charlotte Mason and how to do it, go into a little bit more detail even than what I've gone into today. And we've got my family, we own Ancient Paths Christian Bookstore. We have Charlotte Mason, we've got her 6 volumes that she wrote on how to teach children. We've got it in a book if you want to read it in the original language, and we have a set that's in the modern English. So if you'd like to see that, that's good too. Now I'll tell you, that modern English one, you can read that online if you want to for free. It's at AmblesideOnline.org. You can read that there if you want to, but if you're a book in the hand girl, we've got those too. But okay, I want to just open it up. Does anybody have any questions that they want to ask? Yes. Uh-huh, right.
How do you handle this, children kind of...
Okay, for the recording, I'll just repeat that. You've got 2 children, you've read something to them, you've got at least 2 children that you want to narrate, what do you do? I'll tell you, I've done it 2 different ways. The first way was I start and I let the youngest go first, and I let them narrate, and then I'll go to the next oldest child and I'll say, okay, was there something else that happened that this one didn't say, and let them tell the next thing. Or... an alternative to that is, for each time you're going to do a narration, just have one child do it. Every child does not have to narrate every chapter that you read. If you do that to your children, you're going to ruin reading for them. If they think, I'm going to be tested on it after every chapter, they're not going to want to do it, and it's going to become too burdensome for them, especially when they start writing their narrations. My oldest daughter loves to read, but if I start telling her to narrate every chapter, she's just like, she doesn't want to read the next chapter because, you know, she has to do another narration. So I just say every 2 or 3 chapters, you know, depending on how long they are or what have you. So that's how I've solved that one. Yes?
How often do you do, like, a week do you do the poets and composers?
Generally, okay, how often a week do I do poets and composers? Usually about 2 days a week on each of those.
And picture studies.
Yeah, and we'll do 1 picture a week, and I'll have them look at it.
Do you do it every day?
No. We do it twice a week. I let them look at it. We narrate it. The second time, I'll probably ask them to try to copy the picture or a part of the picture. If there's a lot of stuff going on in the picture, I'll say, you know, why don't you draw this bird, that flower, that person, whatever in the picture. So we do that. The same with music study. It's about twice a week that we really do any talking about it. I try to play the CD every day at some point, but it's not always real. Okay, everybody stop and listen to the CD. You know, it's playing sometimes in the background of what we're doing. There is at least twice a week that I say, okay, let's sit down and listen to this and really pay attention to what's going on. But those kinds of things, you don't want to do it every single day because it can get burdensome. And again, short lessons, short time periods really helps them pay attention and stay with it. So, yes. Okay, what do I use for math? Personally, I don't even start math till about 2nd or 3rd grade. I just kind of see how they're doing. And before that, it's all games and counting and sorting, and it's just, there's no curriculum to it. 2nd or 3rd grade, I start using Making Math Meaningful. And just this year, we went to teaching textbooks for the older ones. So that starts in, I think, 4th grade. So we do that for our math.
Are you from Missouri or Illinois? Because I have a question about logging hours.
Illinois.
Okay.
And so I'm not as familiar. No, I don't. I don't know about Missouri. So logging hours, yeah, you'll have to.
Because it is a more fluid approach, so you have to just sort of.
Yes. I need to find who's doing Charlotte Mason in Missouri because I know I've heard of some, but I off the top of my head I don't. I'm afraid I can't answer. I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah.
Can I just comment on that?
Sure.
We've done it. Basically, if you're doing a lesson, if you're having a nature study, then you count that as an hour. If you're doing whatever your lesson is, you count that as an hour of whatever.
Okay. So each lesson is an hour,
each
is that what you're saying? Okay.
Okay. It doesn't have to be a clock hour.
Okay.
Don't get yourself worked up on the clock hour because that could make you crazy.
Okay. Great. Thank you. I'm so glad that you knew. Okay. Yes.
Science for older kids.
Mm-hmm.
Using Apologia and trying to still use Charlotte Mason, the textbook reads living.
Mm-hmm.
But then it always has the test at the end of the chapter. My children do not do well with that test. And they proved to me one day, because they bombed. They literally bombed the test. They didn't have any of the information. But then I asked them, you know, to tell me, to narrate to me, what did you learn? And they did pick up on some of it, but they still weren't able to answer the question. So where, when they're older, do you find, I mean, do you just forget trying to get them to answer those questions and let them continue to narrate? Or do you
start with the narration. Do the narration first and have them tell you what they learned. And look at the test, and if there's anything that they didn't bring up, if you can ask the question from the test or what have you. My oldest is in eighth grade. Right now we're doing building blocks of science, and so she's doing lots of narration. They have some writing assignments in there and that kind of thing that she's doing, so I'm using that also. But I would start with the narration, and remember that you have the freedom as a homeschooler to teach the way you want to. Even though the book says do this, this, or this, you've got the freedom to do it. And if there's something they didn't get, have them either go back and read it out of that book, or if you're aware of some other living book resource that you could use for that, let them do it.
Are there other suggestions that you have specifically for science?
Boy, you know, as we've studied science, the way I've chosen to do it is we've done biographies of scientists. So when we were learning, we just did George Washington Carver for, I don't remember how that came up, but somebody got interested in him, and so we got some books on him and did that. And so my kids know about the peanuts and how he came up with all those ideas. Thomas Edison, when you're wanting to learn about electricity, that's a great guy to study. Find who was it that developed that branch of science, and go find a biography on him that's age appropriate at the library and do it, and have them read that. That might be how they need to get it. So, and sometimes you have to say, put the science book down for this week and we'll read the biography and learn it that way. So that's one way you could do it. Okay. Yeah.
What's your favorite poet? I haven't heard poetry that I love poetry, but I can never find that.
When they're real young, Robert Louis Stevenson is a great one to use. He wrote the book A Child's Garden of Verses. Also, somebody can tell me how to pronounce this name once and for all. The guy who wrote Winnie the Pooh, A.A. Milne? Oh, somebody said Milne. Which is it? Is it Milne? Milne. I'm hearing Milne. Okay, well, I'm going to go with Milne. So he's a great one to do. Emily Dickinson. My daughter has fallen in love with Emily Dickinson. I'm drawing blanks now.
I've seen a compilation called The Harp and Laurel Wreath.
Oh, yeah, Harp and the Laurel Wreath. Okay. Okay, you will find great poet recommendations on Ambleside Online. That's on the resource sheet back there that you can get. But they've got great recommendations, and we've done several of them, I know. Yes?
History. You said you based all your stuff on history. How do you choose?
History is our core, and we have used Diana Waring's materials. I wanted to go in order, so I started at Genesis, Ancient Civilizations, and the Bible goes Genesis to Christ, and then the next one goes from Romans all the way up to the American Revolution, and the next one goes all the way up through the Korean War. And she does it from a world history perspective, but here's why I like Diana Waring. She addresses every learning style. Each unit is broken down into 4 weeks, and each week focuses on a different learning style. But she has got extensive book list recommendations for each unit, and she tells you what age level it's appropriate for. So when we're studying Marco Polo, I went and found a book that was for elementary age, one for middle school age, one for high school age, and I try to have my children, I read to them or have them read just a little above their level because it keeps stretching them and keeps them growing. Otherwise, they'll stagnate. So that's been our core that we've used. And then she also does CDs where she tells you the stories behind everything, and she's so passionate and enthusiastic, it's very easy to listen to. Even my four-year-old, she asks to listen to Diana Waring very often when we get into the van. Can we turn on Diana Waring? So that's what we have used. And I've just used that to tell me what to study when, and she will tell you some of the artists that were in that time period and things like that also. So that has helped me to pick my artists and all that. So that's really been kind of our core, our guide. I don't do it exactly the way she has it written out, but I do it in a Charlotte Mason way. So, yes.
Yeah. From a very young age.
Mm-hmm. How do you do that without seeming like it seems so overwhelming to kind of hound a child? How did you deal with that?
I started with very short copy work. First of all, I didn't press it real hard in kindergarten. First grade is really where I'm calling it first grade. I've told everybody yesterday my oldest daughter's in seventh grade. She's really in eighth. I don't even know what grade my kids are in because it's all just so easy flowing. But when they get comfortable with writing, that's when I really start pushing the copy work. And if they struggle with doing a whole sentence, do a couple of words. And just have them work on that, you know, to get that down. Go if it's the writing part of it, the forming the letters, go back and work on that before you have them do copy work. But definitely, I'm picky about what's capitalized, what the punctuation is, and the spelling. If you're copying it, you've got it right in front of you, and so you can see it. Again, you do it gently, and you may even do it like this. You have them look at what they wrote. You put the original in front of them and say, "Does this match that?" And let them see it for themselves. And just be very gentle about it. And say, "I'd like for you to make it look just like that for me." And do one word at a time if you have to. If you have to go that slow, then do it. Because I've got some of my kids stress out about things a little bit more than some of the others do. And it's different things for each one. And so it just depends on how your child responds to it. Do as much as you can with them. But if you have to go back to one word at a time, then do that. So whatever works, it's gentle. You can be gentle. Yes.
On the other spectrum, what's the most that could be expected from them when they're older, when they're 6th, 7th grade?
Push them as hard as until you find where it's too hard for them. Just keep pushing until you find what's too hard for them. What we've done is dictate. You move up into dictation after copy work. I really kind of stuck young when I was talking about the copy work because I wanted to just introduce it. But when they get older, you're going to do dictation. And that means you're going to start out giving them a passage to study, and you start with one sentence at a time, and you work up to a paragraph or two. And you give it to them to study for a couple of days, and then you're going to read it to them, and they're going to write it down as you read it. And then you make sure it looks just like the original, just like you did with their copy work. And you do whatever you go up as far as they can in that. And then eventually you get to the point where you're going to dictate something to them that they haven't read yet. And they're going to be able to, by the way you read it, and just by their familiarity with how sentences are structured and the grammar and all that kind of thing, they should be able to write it without having ever seen it just because you read it to them. So you're going to move all the way up to that when they're in their upper years of school. So, and right now where we are is I'm giving it to my oldest two to study for a few days, and then I dictate it to them. So eventually we'll get with my oldest to where I'm going to read her something that she's never seen before. So, yes, you had a question.
I was going to say, a good thing for writing, handwriting mechanics and copy work is reason for handwriting.
A reason for handwriting. Okay, I'm not familiar with that one. Okay.
Like 2 words a day.
Okay.
You copy, and then you copy the whole proverb at the end.
Oh, okay.
Very short ones for young people.
Oh, that's great. Okay.
But also, I was going to ask you about Charlotte. Did she vary the order each day that you did the lessons?
You know, Charlotte Mason, at the end of every school year, she destroyed her curriculum because she didn't want anybody to depend on how she did it. So I don't know, from year to year or from day to day, she may have changed it. The important question to ask is what fits for your family. Do your kids like the steady routine of knowing I'm going to do this and then this and then this and then this? If so, then do it that way. If they get bored with that, change it up. Do what's right for you and your kids. So that's what I would suggest on that one. Okay, did somebody over here have a
question?
Yes.
In regard to learning to read.
Yes.
Is it reading by, I've read somewhere it was by sight words, reading sight words, or is it a phonics?
I've always used a phonics approach.
Okay,
phonics. And, boy, Ruth Beechick is a great resource for that. Her style is a little bit like Charlotte Mason's. She's Ruth Beechick, B-E-E-C-H-I-C-K. She's written 3 little books called An Easy Start in Writing, An Easy Start in Math, and An Easy Start in Language. And she gave great ideas. She said you focus on the sounds that the letters make, and then eventually you work up towards them. I've used How to Teach Your Child to Read in 100 Easy Lessons. I did that with my oldest, but I will say she's the one who struggles the most with spelling. With my son, I started working with him, and he really just kind of picked it up. I went, wow, that was a breeze. And now I'm working on another one, and we're working through alpha phonics. and she's picking it up quite well too. So, but I like the phonics approach because I think that helps them. Then when they see a new word, they decipher it better.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? So, okay, yes.
Okay, I like the living books and things.
Mm-hmm.
My problem is wanting to do everything.
Yeah.
I see a list of 50 books. I want to read them all.
Yeah. Yes.
And also when I'm reading, when we're studying one certain thing, I'm thinking about all the things that we're not doing, you know, that I want to get to.
You know, I have fought those kind of feelings too, and I'm one who I can't sit and do something without knowing what other stuff is going on over here, and sometimes it's in my head or sometimes it's in the house, but it's that same thought, oh, we should be doing more, I got to hurry up and get to the next thing. But that's when you're going to overwhelm your kids. So that trying to decide what to do when, that's that dependence on the Holy Spirit and just asking God to lead you to where to what he wants you to do. Ambleside Online, I keep talking about them. There's other websites too that are on that resource sheet. Some of them will say, you know, do this, this, and this in their first year, and this, this, and this in their second year. And if you want to follow that pattern because that helps you relax a little bit, then do it. But just remember that God doesn't expect you or your kids to accomplish all 50 of those books in a week. You know, he may put that list in front of you and say, I'd like for you to get through some of these, but he's not going to expect you to do it in a week. And your kids can't handle it. You know, we can handle all that thought process, can't we? We can think about all the dozens of other things that are out there that we could be doing, and all our kids know is what's right in front of them. And so just let your child enjoy that book. Work through it slow and steady, and you'll get it done, and you'll get done with what God wants you to get done. So there's great resources out there. Just pick one and go with it. You know, I really think that as long as you're depending on the Holy Spirit and your desire is for your children to grow up the way they should and get a good education, then it's going to happen. So I really think it will. So, yeah.
You said that you do read aloud in the afternoon and in the evening?
Are yes.
The same book or different books?
No, different books.
Different books?
I usually have the read aloud that we're usually doing as me and the kids is usually something to do with our history. And then in the evening, it's usually something else. We've done like the Elsie books, and we're trying to get through Pilgrim's Progress. That's taking forever. And around Thanksgiving, we always read Plymouth Plantation and things like that. So it just kind of that's just kind of free and easy, that evening read aloud. And that's usually read aloud that Dad does. So somebody else? Does somebody else have something? Yes.
So are all the kids kind of all like doing the same general thing at the same time?
Usually, although now my oldest daughter, she really is kind of branching out on her own. Right now she's doing science on her own. Definitely math is at their own level. But everything else we do together. Now when it comes to history, here's how I view the way that I'm teaching the kids, especially with history. I kind of look at it like a train. And we all get on the train and we start moving down the track. And I read the article to them out of Diana Waring's things. We start reading books, and I start with the easiest books, and then we move up. And as we get to a point that's beyond the youngest one's ability to keep going, she gets off, and she maybe colors or whatever while I keep moving forward with the older ones. And we just keep going until we've hit, for the oldest one, hit her lesson level, and then we're done. So I kind of like to look at it that way. And I do, when we're doing school, we're all together. There's a few things that my oldest kids are doing on their own. I'm a firm believer in teaching them how to type and good handwriting skills, and like I said, my oldest is on her own on science. And so they do those things on their own. But when it comes to history and read-alouds and those kinds of things, poetry study, artist study, all that, we do all that together.
You're sitting around the table, or you're mm-hmm. in the living room? Or
it depends, whatever's most comfortable. For artist study, we're definitely at the table because I like to have something, you know, if they're going to be copying it or whatever, then I want them to have a place to sit. But if we're reading, I try to be in the living room, just try to be as comfortable as possible. It's great, too, because I sit on the floor, and I have a couple of them behind me. If it's a picture book, they can see over my shoulders, and I always make somebody rub my shoulders while I read. So. Yeah.
What's the best book to learn? I mean, you've given us a great overview today. What's the best book to learn the Charlotte Mason?
This Charlotte Mason Companion. This is it. This is the one. It's very easy reading. Charlotte's words are... It's just heavy to get through. She was very Victorian in the language that she used, and there's a lot of references to her day in England. But this is somebody who's doing it today, and she takes each thing. You know, this is how we did artist study. This is where I came up with my music for my composer study. All that, and it's very down to earth. I mean, she didn't have when they got started, she didn't have unlimited resources. Nobody has unlimited resources, but she had to be very creative in how she did it, and it gave me great ideas. So this is it. Well, listen, we've hit our time that we're supposed to be done, so I'm going to stop now. If you have any further questions, feel free to stop by our booth downstairs. I'll be happy to talk to you. Thank you so much.